This is Surviving the Music Industry.
That sounds sick.
I didn't think about how that sounded.
All right, folks, we're back at doing the thing. I'm here to do the thing, and you want to listen to the thing. So here's the thing. I'm Brandon. You're listening to SMI. And this is the part where I usually gripe and complain. I try not to. I try to throw in a little hint of positivity and some optimism, but that's not the fence post I usually lean on. And so it's usually just frustration and anger, and I don't know what to do with myself like half the time because I'm still figuring things out. So you're on this road and this journey of me just trying to figure shit out. But then also, I get to have pretty rad conversations. And you guys like stuck with us for like 5 years. This is insane. I mean, huge gratitude. I know people that don't stick around in marriages for like 5 years. So it's pretty insane, like, the think back on this thing. And, you know, we're approaching like 200 epis and we're still here. We're still alive and kicking. Call it be dumb. Call it naivety if you like. I don't know. But you guys really seem to enjoy. I mean, birds of a feather flock together. And you enjoy pretty rad conversations with musicians. And they're just doing the thing that they do. They're being creative. And sometimes they're freaks and aliens. And I kind of want to know what's in their brains. And we get down to the thing. And it's great. This conversation was gnarly. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. Rebecca and Megan of Larkin Poe. They're great, obviously. Right? But this day of recording this conversation, I don't remember where I was because some folks have been following my journey of moving out and we were buying a house at the same time. Privilege problems, I know. Don't throw the cancel hate on me just yet. At least wait till I think I would deserve it. But then going back and listening to this, it was a little cringeworthy. And I think it was me because I had some high anxiety that day. I think I was moving. Or we have moved out, and there was just stuff I had to do. But this was like the only day we could do it. I mean, huge props to their publicists for like hooking this shiz up. Emily, I like the folks at Big Hassle, and it's not because they let me talk to their peeps, but I mean, they know what they're doing. They just know what they're doing. That's a little too industry insider, but Emily's rad, but she hooked up this conversation with Rebecca and Megan. It was in the morning, too. I feel like there was just like a tornado of twister of things of like that could go wrong. And not to say that things didn't go wrong, but like I said, it's me. I mean, if it was a bad date, ladies, Rebecca and Megan, I mean, famous last words from a crappy boyfriend. It was me, not you guys, for sure. Because we did the thing, and it was a lot of fun. But going back to listening to this, I kind of cringed just a little bit. And I don't know. I just wish I was on my game. And it made me realize, too, more things about myself. And maybe I'm too hard on myself. And that's just the nature. And that's the beast of this thing that I'm trying to do within entertainment is and then music, too, of I don't allow myself to be human, you know? I feel like it always has to be like this thing constantly, and it's just, it's on par or above. It can't even be par, and I don't even get golfing terms, but it just can't be like the same average thing, right? But we always forget about this human element and quality, and I always forget. And then when I try to make it something that it's not, my anxiety is just through the roof. And I call it anxiety because I don't know what else to call it, but it was a learning lesson for me more than anything. And maybe I can echo that to anybody that hasn't skipped so far that we can get into the thing of, I mean, just allow yourself to be human a little bit. I certainly don't. And that's hard for me. That's a hard concept because, you know, the sound wasn't right. I was in the old place. And of course, all the acoustic treatment was out of the room. And so I was just trying to make do. And it was in the morning. And nobody really likes to have like deep heart crying talks in the morning. And I mean, unless it's Gilmore Girls, I guess. But then at the same time, it just wasn't like a perfect storm in my head. But to be honest with you, It was fine. It was good. It was great. We did the thing. We got to know Rebecca and Megan on a different level. Got some stuff I kind of never knew. I mean, I wonder if super fans might even have known. some of this stuff. But at the same time, listening back at this, when I finally got done listening to it, and I said, you know what? I'm human. We're all human, and you have to accept that. And sometimes that's really hard to accept, especially in this time. I mean, especially for people trying to be proactive and do their thing that they're trying to do, and especially to find some kind of normalcy and some patterns that they're trying to get used to, and whatever culture that you're kind of finding yourself in, especially these days. We're not allowing ourselves like to be human and allow error, and it's a... I don't know. It's a tricky thing, right? I mean, even in Nashville, oh, Mayor Coop, there's something going on there. I mean, especially with the emails and the COVID cases not being right, and maybe a lot of people feel lied to. Listen, folks, you know me. I don't get, like, too political. I mean, we'll have conversations, but I won't get into it personally because it's a lack of knowledge. And the big thing for me, I guess, to try to bring it back around to this whole situation is that, you know, they're just human too. I feel like they're just trying to figure shit out just like the rest of us, you know. But, the, you know, they got a spotlight and they're supposed to be taking care of us, and maybe that's where they messed up. I'm not trying to take care of anybody. I barely even take care of the little Mowgli Jungle Book kid I even have, but I want to send him out in the woods and, like, fend for yourself. Mowgli did it. Don't call CDC or the Children Protective Services or whoever, whatever. It was a joke. Calm down. But it was good. We got it. And I'm allowing myself to be human in this conversation. But it was kind of a perfect storm. I was moving. Sound just wasn't right. But we got through the thing. And it was nice to meet Rebecca and Megan, Larkin Poe. I never met them. I've been fans of their music. So we eventually got it. We got it, folks. We got it. But getting ready for this conversation... I mean, I didn't have to work too hard. I already listened to their music. I already knew the thing, right? I think I was kind of introduced to them like around Peach, their records. And then Venom of Faith was a huge thing, got a big old Grammy nod. And so, I mean, I listened as a, you know, just a listener of rock. I mean, I feel like we kind of share a lot of the same influences. I think it was Rebecca posted something on the Grams about playing Electric Funeral. Got me listening to Black Sabbath again. I just ordered Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath on vinyl, and I'm super stoked about that, but I'm getting way off topic. But it's, we got through the thing. I feel like we share a lot of interest And I got to know the band because I really didn't know too much history. We didn't spend a lot of time in the history, but there was a third, and we got into that. But most of all, we just talked about, I think, the most important things and the issues at hand is their newest record, Self-Made Band, especially where these characters come from and how they're flipping the script of in this perception where it kind of meets authenticity. And that's something I'm putting on them. I don't know if they really accept that, but it's that. At least something I kind of share from this new project. And I'm not going to explain too much, but we get into it. I think some big things, some big news that you need to really be made aware of is that they're starting the Larkin Poe podcast. Clever name. One is already passed, but there's one coming up on October 4th that you can get those tickets. And it's an acoustic band show. They're doing the thing. And the best way to get those tickets, I would think, is that you got to go to larkinpoe.com. We'll have links on our website, smipodcast.com. But while you're even there, I guess with the old larkinpoe.com, you can go give them a follow. Check out all their stuff at Larkin Poe. It's an original name. And so you don't have to search too hard. It will pop up. They even have like tour dates going on their website. That's a new, fresh thing I haven't been seeing on websites here lately. Hope that happens, ladies. Hope that works out for you guys. But, I mean, this conversation is chock full. I mean, we talked about some of the characters, the things in their music, especially from the album Self-Made Band. And a lot of deep stuff, too. And especially in the creative headspace. And so I really appreciate their time getting to know them. Again, go to larkinpoe.com. Take a look at Larkin Poe Podcast. The next date is October 4th. Go get your tickets at larkinpoe.com. Self-Made Man is the newest record. Go give them a follow. Give them a shout at Larkin Poe. And a couple of things. I said Brent Cobb, and I really meant Dave Cobb. I'm telling you guys, I messed up, like, in this conversation. Just allow me to be human for once. How about that? And then, so instead of Brent, it's supposed to be Dave. And it was in the morning. So here we are. We're trying to get to know one another in the morning.
Oh, I'm an early bird, so I've been up for a minute. This is Rebecca. Our voices are similar, so we'll do our best to like tell you who is who as we go.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about phoners, and I fucking hate phoners, and I fucking hate the Rona. It's killing me. But we'll get through it. We'll get through it all together.
That's life, ain't it?
Yeah. I guess it was Megan. She said that you guys aren't, I guess you guys don't live together. Are you guys I know you guys are in Nashville, but how far apart do you guys live from one another?
We live 10 minutes apart from each other. As the crow flies, like 5. But yeah, with Nashville traffic being super light this spring, it's like we basically are neighbors. It's awesome.
Yeah. I couldn't live close to my siblings. That's why I live 9 hours away. So I'm just glad that you guys get along.
We are too. In our early 20s, I do think, you know, we had some molehills to climb as siblings in a band, because I do think that sibling bands kind of get the rap of, you know, being somewhat dramatic. You have a lot of feuding sibling bands that keep popping up in the tabloids and whatnot. But between Megan and I, we're really close in age. And ever since we were little kids, we've kind of been a package deal. So I think that in a lot of ways we have this really this well-honed dysfunction that like isn't super unhealthy, but you know, at the same time definitely exists. But we love each other, and that's what matters most.
I love that. Oh, yeah. I love that, because I feel like my sisters can't say the same, because I have two older sisters and I was the baby. And
ooh.
Yeah, I never saw a bathroom until they moved out. That was the big thing in our house. But the biggest memory I have of them is like, it was just like bloody murder fights, like over like the dumbest shit, like maybe just shoes or something, for example.
Yeah, we definitely can. I mean, I feel like sibling relationships, they're so complicated. Like when you actually take a step back and you look at what you're expecting people to do. You know, certainly when you're born into a family, there's a lot of kinship and familiarity and shared memories, but you're talking about really different people all living under the same roof. And especially when you're going through, you know, your teen years, like we're all just little, you know, we can be kind of buttholes, and that's okay. But I think especially like with Megan and I, like having that complicated sibling dynamic, and then building like 18 other layers of relationship on top of that, from songwriting collaborators to producers to businesswomen together owning our own record label, and then also touring. On top of that, touring, oh my gosh, which is like, I feel like touring is this potential cesspool for just drama and chaos. And I think it's been a real learning lesson between the two of us, like figuring out how to navigate as sisters together. But ultimately, like we're like, you know, 30, 29.
I mean, could we push each other's buttons all the time? Absolutely.
Yes.
And easily done.
Yeah.
So we have to kind of rail against it if we can.
Rein it in. But it does get easier with time too. Like we've been BFFs throughout and had our rough patches. But I feel like it's nice having gotten through kind of the turbulent 20s, and now we're a lot more relaxed in who we are. Not that we don't have meltdowns occasionally, because, you know, making music can be stressful and fun and stressful. So it's good.
But having all these shared memories together and like traveling the world together, it's really special. And I definitely like, I cherish it a good bit.
Yeah, very rewarding.
I love the aspect of, you know, the shared bond of, I mean, besides blood, there's also those experiences too. That's beautiful. I like that. I feel like there's a thing about duos that I've been doing this for a long time, and I feel like there's always a misconception about duos where people kind of fill in the blanks. And so I always like to do this, like with duos, like here's like your chance and like a couple of things like most people get wrong about you guys. So like whatever questions you think I might even ask of you, like, go ahead and get them out of the way right now, if you like, especially about any kind of duo relationship between you and your sister.
Well, just first up, yeah. I'm not Larkin and she's not Poe or vice versa.
Okay, perfect. Keep going. Get them out of the way. Knock them out. Go.
Let's see. I think contrary to popular belief, this is Rebecca speaking, I'm the younger sibling. When Megan wants to speak, she speaks. And I'm not keeping Megan quiet. I think there's this definite sense from fans that I'm kind of like a motor mouth, and and Megan is just, you know, steamrolled by my motor mouth, which in fact is not true.
You're hogging all the airtime, Rebecca.
Hey man, hogging it up. It's true. I suck all every bit of oxygen in the room. I'm like, give me a straw. Let's go. No, but it is true. Like our dynamic is, you know, something that we've been playing with for years, like literally since the cradle. And I think that people can sometimes draw some weird conclusions about, you know, if there's a power struggle between Megan and I. And it's like, no, y'all, like we just are who we are. What are some other big ones, Meg?
Oh man. That probably is one of the bigger ones. I'm a quieter person, not getting steamrolled. Yeah. But
I feel like people who have followed us for many years, there's definitely this sense of maybe sometimes confusion about musically where we exist, because we've done a lot of things throughout our career. We've been making music for 10 years.
So as long.
Play, which is a crazy number to say.
Yeah.
So we've made many different records. We started out really bluegrass, and, you know, through the years we worked through some rock tracks and some country tracks and some, you know, off the wall stuff. But we do not really play traditional bluegrass anymore, which comes as a shocker to some.
Yeah.
We are in fact a roots rock and roll band, and we can get loud. And if people come out on the road, they will see us with a band. It'll be drums and bass, and then Megan and I kind of stomping around up front. And we will, in fact, not be playing many covers in our set, because we are, I think, somewhat known on the internet for doing cover series. We have this YouTube series called Tip of the Hat, which has been awesome, and we love it. And it has been actually such a great companion for us during quarantine and getting to still connect with people. But we don't really do that in our shows. We're an all-original band.
We kind of do get some comments like, oh, you guys should try writing your own material. It's like, well, check out
As a matter of fact... that's a little surprising to me a little bit, but you know, I always do like just a quick Google search, like what even pops up. And like, have you ever seen those videos of like celebrities like peeling off the stickers of like their most asked Google questions? Have you seen those videos?
There's
a lot about you people. So there's one about like, are you guys partners? That was the one that stuck out. I was like, who is asking that? That's like the most like weirdest thing, especially, I guess, if you don't know if they're sisters. But it's just the assumptions of people. The assumptions of people amaze me. And the list kind of just goes on and on. So that's why I always like that to you guys. Like, go for it. Get it all out of the way and we can move on.
Yeah, it's funny. I do feel that we are pretty transparent in the messaging of being sisters. Like, I think being sisters is pretty much, you know, one of the biggest things about our band that we wind up talking a lot about, because it truly is one of, I think, the most integral backbone pieces of Lock and Poe. So yeah, whenever we do get the are you partners, or, you know, kind of the weird internet trolley comments about, you know, things that we might should consider doing on camera, it's like, y'all, just no.
Yeah,
many levels, just no. Like, we're all here for the music. Let's keep it cool. Let's keep it clean.
Right. Like, it's the weirdest thing. I feel like you don't ask two guys that, you know, the same thing. Like, it's a weird dichotomy of where we go in with assumptions. And every time somebody mentions troll, my imagination immediately goes to Danny DeVito's character in Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So, like, I just feel like there's just some dude on the internet that is, like, just asking these, like, creepy questions. And I toured for, like, 15, 20 years. And one of the biggest acts I played in, it was a woman singer. The weirdest thing, because it would have these interactions just like this. Mm. And so I feel like your guys' story, like, on the road, probably no different, and we'll probably get there, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I think specifically the internet can kind of bring out the worst in a lot of us. You know, it can be very addictive and very anonymous, which I think are two A words that can be very triggering for a lot of people. You know, I definitely find myself, you know, being on social media is part of our job. But there are moments where I think people maybe assume like that we spend more time on social media than we actually do. Like, I think people can sometimes not keep it in context. Like, that this is kind of a part of our job as well, posting content and interacting with people. But like, we don't have personal Facebook pages or Instagram pages, because it's such a great time commitment for people to be online and creating content, you know, so trying to have some boundaries that exist there. But it can be like this kind of void of people just spilling their energy in and really investing a lot of self-worth. I mean, I feel like this is definitely a hot button conversation, you know, with quarantine and everyone being at home and having everything transferred online so much more even than before, which is definitely saying something. So I understand, like, I understand that it's hard to communicate a story to people through the internet because we are also distracted and there's so much competing for our attention. So I get it, like, when people can slip up and be like, well, who are these girls? Like, what are they? Are right. they partners or what? So it's like, it's understandable and you can't get your feelings hurt. But there are, of course, certain breaches of etiquette that exist that are very
right.
uneven for people.
Right.
It's like, just don't hit send. Type it and then delete it. Do not hit send. You don't gotta post that, man.
Oh, the opposable thumb is such a villain for so many, where it's a useful tool for others. Like, it's like people just send that shit out in the world. Well, I think this is a like perfect way, like, because I don't know you, we've never met or anything, but I'm excited to get to know you guys on this level because I've loved the music for years. So this is going to be fun for me.
Thanks.
But there's a lot of things I still don't know. Like, I know you're from Georgia and I'm from Texas, and there's nothing more annoying, I feel like, are people from Texas and also Georgia. I feel like those people like love their states for some weird ass reason. Are you guys like that?
Well, technically we were born in Tennessee.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Where?
We were born in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Okay.
Land of Dolly Parton.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, well, okay. Well, what was the journey to Georgia then? What was that?
Our parents moved us down there to Calhoun, Georgia, which is a little bit north of Atlanta. We were pretty young when we moved.
Okay.
A few years old. Okay. You know, we didn't have much say. They kind of strapped us in the car seats, and so we went. But, you know, I think it was probably, what, maybe 4 or 5 years ago we moved back to Nashville.
Mm-hmm. That 5 years.
I say back like we've been here before. We never lived in Nashville previously, but we obviously spent a lot of time. But yeah, 3-4 years. It's been nice. Nashville's great. And I don't know that you, I mean, I'm married to a Texan, and I kind of, he is Texas proud, but I don't find it super annoying. I guess it depends on the degree of, you know, fervor with which you love your state.
Yes, 100%. There's like a degree. It's like there's a scale of like Matthew McConaughey and like some like George W. Bush or something. You know, there's like the cool Texan that's
sure.
like, oh, okay, cool, they're from Texas. And there's this guy like holding a gun and never inhaled. And it's just kind of like, yep, Texas forever.
Oh,
and
man.
So it's the full gamut. Texas is like a weird country to me. And I'm like from there. But yeah, but every time I've met somebody from Georgia, it feels like the same thing. Like they just truly love that. So there I go, assuming that you guys about the same position too.
Well, I don't think that you're wrong. I mean, I think that we identify very strongly as Georgia peaches. And there's a lot of cool stuff that has come out of Georgia, you know, Vidalia Onion, we got blueberries going on, we got rock and roll, you know, with the Allman Brothers and all the stuff coming out of Macon musically. So there's a lot that's going for Georgia, and it's a beautiful state. Like we've definitely written a lot of songs about the mountains of Northern Georgia and really having so many wonderful memories as children, being able to grow up in the country because we were homeschooled on 70 acres in Northern Georgia. And we had, I think, given that we were born in the early 90s, we had somewhat of an unusual experience as kids, being, you know, kind of true tomboys and reading a lot of Laura Ingalls Wilder and, you know, books about
the woods.
Oh, totally, yeah, building forts. Like, you know, our parents built the house that we grew up in. So we kind of, you know, came up on a building site, and that Megan and I just took that and ran with it. And, you know, we're allowed a lot of pretty cool experiences. So I think that we have a lot of hometown pride for Georgia, Northern Georgia.
Little House on the Prairie reference. A lot of people probably won't catch that one right off the bat. But then...
Oh, you know it.
Yeah, I know. I'm hearing it. And then 70 acres, homeschool. What did your parents do then?
They're both in the medical field, and our dad is a pathologist, and my mom actually stayed home to raise us, so she kind of took our schooling under her belt.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Previously, yeah, she was an occupational therapist, but I do think that one of the biggest identifying factors about our folks is they're extreme do-it-yourselfers. So when I say that we, you know, grew up on a building site, it's definitely our parents were out there, like, doing crazy labor, bringing down trees, building wrought iron fencing, pouring the basement, like...
And this was before YouTube, so they were kind of teaching themselves to do it without
they were renting,
I don't know how they did it.
They were renting books from the library, borrowing books, you know,
what
and,
is
like,
that?
Reading about how to... I know, it's so cool. Yeah. They were, you know, real Renaissance men, both of them, and I think that that's something that we definitely... took, you know, countless pages out of their books and have applied that to the way that we have, you know, structured our lives to date and feel very empowered by that.
Wow. Okay. So you guys didn't want, and there's a sister involved. I know that. I know Jessica is somewhere in the mix. Is there another sibling or is it just the three of you?
There's
got a little one as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's 14 years younger.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. All right, so it's pretty big family, medical doctor. So you guys didn't want to go through, like, the family business of medicine.
I mean, interestingly, I don't know that we had ever had great designs on being professional musicians. Like, that's fair to say.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think I always assumed I would be a pathologist like my dad. I was the youngest of the three girls, and I would routinely wear a tie. Like, my mom let me buy a clip-on tie from the Goodwill in Calhoun. Bless her for letting me be myself. And
amazing.
I would wear my little clip-on tie like my dad and carry a briefcase around. So I definitely thought that I was going to be a pathologist until, lo and behold, you know, here Megan and I are 29 and 30, and we're musicians. So who does thunk it, you know, true to stranger than fiction.
Well, okay, there's a lot to unpackage there. I mean, I feel like dad specifically, but I bet mom has some opinions, especially about this COVID-19 stuff, especially for what they do.
Oh, I think regardless of medical backgrounds, everyone has an opinion.
True, true. But I bet you guys get an earful.
Yeah, well, you know, our family, I respect our parents and our father, especially for the amount of time that he spends researching and reading and trying to stay abreast of, you know, global affairs. And I think it's a very chaotic time. You know, we are living in an unprecedented era of, you know, media's involvement in, you know, the way that information is disseminated. And there's a lot of, you know, conflicting opinions. And we, you know, can go on Twitter and you can Google. And, you know, we have all of this, these outlets at our fingertips. And I think it's a confusing time to try and construct opinions. But I do think that trying to stay informed and stay engaged and trying to fact check yourself and read as much as you can to form an opinion is really admirable for people today. And I think that our folks definitely do that. So I think to answer your question, yes, we do get an earful.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I mean, even to that, I had this thing in my imagination. I mean, I don't know if it's true. I guess it's just my opinion. But in the age of information, we have so much information. And it's so hard mm-hmm. to like even... like see through, like actually what is the thing, you know, because I'm no MD. I'm not going to tell anybody like you have to wear a mask or you shouldn't wear a mask because I don't know. I just happen to wear a mask because it sounds right. I'm okay with that. But then it's also the thing of like, well, if you actually know a medical doctor, that's at least in-house. I mean, they know what's up. And like the whole perception for me changed, especially when I started talking and asking questions to a medical professional, mm-hmm. like in person. So, I mean, that was a game changer for me, for sure.
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's also fair to say that even, you know, even if you've got a medical degree and, you know, you're further educated on a topic, I do think it's important to realize that even then we're allowing our emotions to sway us on occasion and accepting when things yeah. are or are not being politicized in the way in which, you know, we figure out how best to move through the world. It's just, I'm just going to go back to say it's confusing. It's a confusing time. Mm. But yeah, you can better bet like anytime, especially with the amount of touring that we've done over the years, you know, we'll be in freaking Sweden and calling our dad
on the, you know, the sat phone. Dad, I have this bruise on my leg that looks strange. Please tell me whether or not I'm going to die from this bruise. That's our dad, you know.
Oh, that's amazing. That's like a doctor's like worst nightmare, but he can't say that because it's like your kid,
it's
you know?
True. Oh my gosh. We've had crazy situations over the years. My sister and I, like, as you can see, I'm doing that thing that Rebecca does where she sucks all the air out of the room where I'm just talking ad nauseum. But we've never been big partiers on the road. We started touring so young as kids. We were like 15, 16. So we've never been big drinkers or partakers of stuff that would, you know, potentially negatively impact our ability to like play music and keep ourselves safe. But we've definitely had some party hardy band members. And so, I mean, there've been late night phone calls to our dad where it's like, oh my gosh, Dad, the drummer got drunk and fell and it's like almost bashed his face in. What do we do? We're in a foreign country. Do we take him to the ER, you know? And our poor dad is, I'm sure, sweating bullets trying to figure out how to, you know, coach his daughters on taking care of a band employee that is, you know, currently ranting Looney Tunes.
He's bleeding
in the
out.
Shower.
I don't know how to do a splint.
No, exactly.
It's like our pets' heads are falling off.
Exactly. Perform CPR. Perform CPR.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty rad of your parents because I know of the Lovell sisters, and that was kind of, I feel like, a genesis of like your profesh music career. But I mean, that's pretty rad of your parents to say, you know, go ahead, go do the thing. I mean, were they all both pretty open to this? Because when I think about doctors, I think of institution, always thinking about 4 or 5 next steps ahead. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this thing of music, it's like, well, I don't even know what I'm going to drink in 30 minutes, you know?
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely a feeling of being very nervous for us, especially looking back now. It must have been very difficult to give us that freedom to go out on the road, because at first they did go with us. And this is when we were kind of thinking it was more of a hobby, because at first it was a hobby. And then we went on, you remember A Prairie Home Companion with Garrison Keillor on NPR.
I do.
Yeah, he had this teen talent competition, and we went on as the Lovell sisters with Jessica, our older sister, and we ended up winning this teen talent competition on air, and that kind of launched everything for us. So we kind of went from just sending in a tape just on a whim and to, you know, touring almost full time from year one. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that any of us knew exactly what we were getting into. But I do appreciate, looking back, their sort of support and not just saying, oh, absolutely no, but allowing us to kind of try out this opportunity and see if we liked it.
Yeah, that takes risk. And I just feel like it's not a personality of a doctor. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's like love, or they saw a passion. I don't know. I feel like there's just something there.
Well, I think that there's, you know, it's safe to say that we're also not your, you know, your run-of-the-mill musician. I think people still kind of maintain this somewhat outdated stereotype of what a musician is. Like, you know, you have these Spinal Tap references where you see these kind of, you know, bumbling individuals that are, you know, talented and charismatic, but they're not able to like take care of themselves. And so artists have managers and labels to pour money into them, and they live these lavish, you know, crazy lifestyles. When in fact, that's not true for the majority of musicians out there really grinding at trying to make a living. Like, that's a very archaic idea, and one that I think is going away even faster now than ever. You have, you know, musicians that are really hardworking, really smart, strategic people. Like, I mean, I think it's no accident when you do research on Garth Brooks and a handful of these other, like, you know, really wildly successful individuals. Garth Brooks had a marketing degree. Like, he was a marketing guy. It's no accident. So the way that our folks raised us, you know, to be do-it-yourselfers and to think for yourself and to see how you can better a situation by being in the situation, I think that they really did set us up to be able to run a small business, because that's what we're doing. Like, we're getting to create art and make music and express ourselves creatively and to put voice to feeling. But I think also you're running a small business and, you know, thinking about, like you're saying, you know, thinking five steps ahead in terms of, all right, well, we're going to release a record on this date. What are the things that need to be done before that point in time? And what's the new merch going to look like? And how can we actually, you know, not lose money? Because I think many artists, right, you know, you hemorrhage money. It's really expensive to take.
It goes so quick.
Yeah, and to take a band out on the road, like, touring is the fastest way to lose money. And it's really interesting because, you know, like, you'll be chatting with fans online and, you know, they'll leave a comment like, please come to such and such small town. And in our hearts, there's nothing more than we would love to come to the such and such small town, but the logistics of bringing like a crew of, you know, in the beginning, five people, and then you add on your front of house engineer and your lighting guy and the person that helps you tune the guitars on stage, and then suddenly you're carrying 8 to 10 people with you everywhere you go, and you have to feed them and house them and make sure that, you know, they are safe and getting the medical attention that they need on the given night. And, you know, like, it's really quite a circus that requires some ringleaders at the helm. And I think that we really enjoyed, like, the chaos of that, but then also the underpinnings of, you know, planning and strategy that are involved too. So it really, I think if you're making music in the 21st century and you're independent as we are, and you're not relying on the infrastructure of a recording label, it's a really interesting job to have, because you're wearing by nature a lot of hats.
Yeah, right. Because, I mean, by the time you get a bus and you get your crew together, I mean, you just basically, 10 grand is out the window for like a weekend run.
That's true.
You know, I wish we could go to this middle of nowhere Arkansas town, but man, we need at least like 20 grand. I mean, that's kind of what it takes. And yeah, that's a tough feeling. I understand that for sure. All right. So you guys got all super successful as this trio. And, like, things just started taking off. I mean, I mean, this is the genesis of, I guess, of, like, the birth of Larkin Poe before Larkin Poe, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it kind of implemented this dream or this thing of, like, oh, we could do it. But it was, like, in bluegrass, like in folk music, right? I mean, was it kind of like a Nickel Creek kind of thing with you three, or, like, the Carter sisters? Mm-hmm. I know that's really outdated, but, I mean, like, what was the thing of the Lovell sisters?
I think it was early Alison Krauss. It was very bluegrass.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, we had aspirations to be Nickel Creek, but I think Nickel Creek, they were so forward-thinking. So we were mm-hmm. very traditional bluegrass, and that definitely cemented a deep love, you know, for us, for roots American music and bluegrass. And has definitely been something that we've routinely come back to over the years.
I mean, we did mostly covers of traditional songs for the most part in the beginning. And it wasn't till a little bit later, even in Lovell Sisters, that we started to experiment with even writing our own stuff. And I think that's mm-hmm. probably when there was a shift towards slightly more progressive music. But that was even probably, you know, 4 years in to Lovell Sisters.
That's one thing I always vowed about your music, is that you guys have like kind of an homage to a lot of different things. I mean, there's some Blind Willie influences there. You kind of hear some Booker T, and then there's also, I think, some of that Nickel Creek stuff too. So, I mean, like, you guys are like learned students, I feel like, of music. Because for me, you know, I'm based in Nashville. Like, we're basically neighbors, right? So I can throw a stick and hit a country artist mm-hmm. and they'll pop on the show and we'll kind of go through the thing. And I'm kind of amazed of how much, like, they don't know. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Like, if I throw out, like, maybe even, like, a Don Williams reference or something, and that's okay. They don't have to know who Don Williams is. But you would think, like, some kind of homage or even Willie Nelson. I mean, let's just choose, like, one of the biggest things. And it's kind of like, like, I feel like there's, like, not a respect or, like, an homage to something to, like, been there before.
Sure.
You know what I'm trying to say?
I do. And I think my feeling in response to what you're saying is immediately that there's there's a shift of people's focus, right? Like, I think we live in an unprecedented time where kids are, you know, they've actively done studies and asked kids, like, hey, if you could have a life of celebrity and fame, would you commit to literally only getting like 27, 30 years on the planet? And these kids are saying, absolutely. If it meant that I could be famous, then I would absolutely die young. Just let me have that really star-studded thing and then snuff me out. I'm good to go. So there's a difference, I think, in artists that are, you know, making somewhat surface-level music without having done the research, as opposed to artists that I think are invested in the tradition and the history of how music came to be. Like, it's just a difference of depth and how deep you're willing to dig to understand, you know, the foundations of what you're building on top of it. Why are you building? Are you building something that's going to last, you know, 25, 30 years, 60 years, a century, hundreds of years, or are you literally in it for 27 years of fame? Do you know what I mean?
I hear intention in that. Like, what's the intention?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing really wrong with however you want to do it. Like, we're entitled to a lifespan on this planet. And, you know, once you're born, you'll live it and you get to live it how you want. And how long you live it, you know, that's kind of up to the choices you make or the circumstances that are brought down upon you. But I do feel that Megan and I are really geared towards being curious about the history of music. And, you know, and that's not even entirely chalked up to us. It's kind of who we've been around too, wouldn't you say, Matt?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say that we probably owe a lot of that viewpoint to Elvis Costello, because we did meet him when we were quite young. And being around him, he's like a music historian. Like, he will make you feel 100%. So ignorant about music.
Yes.
That I think that we really aspire to be like him, because it's just so amazing that his musical depth and knowledge, and he's like pulling from it in every kind of music that he plays, because he has made every kind of genre of record, you know, from like punk to almost like operatic, you know, musical type of music. So I think that we really admire that about him. He kind of sent us down that path.
I mean, I've hung out with people that are like super brilliant minded, like Elvis Costello, like Brent Cobb comes to mind. I don't know if you guys ever hung out with Brent, but that dude is an encyclopedia of, I feel like, all things like music, not just like country music.
Yeah.
But his thing is, like, you know, as a producer, like, you can sit there in the background, you'll listen to him talk, or you just kind of see him making notes or like just doing on things. He's just kind of like, yeah, what if we do like a Glenn Campbell, like a string section mix, like with a Don Williams thing.
Yeah.
And then also have a Muscle Shoals like kick drum and a snare with like a California keyboard. Like, it's just, I feel like knowing the things in the past can definitely play in your favor of like creating something so rad and like forward momentum. And that's how I've always felt about some of your guys' songs and like records. There's like the throwback things do nothing but play in your favor of just knowing, one, what's up, but then also like pushing some shit. Pushing it forward.
Certainly. Well, it's the vocabulary, right? Like, there's nothing that breaks my heart more when, you know, I think that both Meg and I have been in sessions before where, you know, you're there as a side musician to like back up an artist, and you see this artist that is being put in a position to have opinions without having that frame of reference or that vocabulary or that musical, you know, history to be able to tell people or to tell their producer what they want, not even really knowing what all the different pieces of the drum kit are, or not knowing how to verbalize what they're hearing in their head because they don't have that framework. And that would be really frustrating. Do you know what I mean? Like, to be in a position when you're trying to make music, but you don't have that education to be able to tell people what you're trying to make. And I think having seen that a couple of times, you know, in action, that really inspires you to educate yourself. And we grew up in a household where all the records were played. You know, our dad was playing classic rock and, you know, new age music and bluegrass and metal. He is a huge Aussie fan. A lot of the Britpunk stuff, like across the board, our parents were spinning so much interesting music. And so that, I think, it fostered in us an interest in a lot of different styles of music. And and makes you want to be able to know how to represent all of those interests and passions into what you're making yourself. And it can feel daunting, I think, maybe at the outset to figure out how to teach yourself because there's so much music and there's so much listening required. And
I feel that
remembering
now.
Of dates. Oh, totally. I mean, I do absolutely like trying to keep dates straight or who influenced who or what came first.
Right.
But I think when you start breaking it down into, okay, what makes me feel, what inspires that passion, and you follow that scent, like a little, you know, like a hound dog on the blood trail, like, there you go. Suddenly you're on this journey of discovery. And I do think that, you know, apps like Spotify and YouTube, they can be such tools because you have so much information at your fingertips to be able to just go on little discovery voyages. And I really think that, you know, in the last 5 years, 4 or 5 years, safe to say, we have definitely done that with the blues and really been bitten by that, the intrigue of the turn of the century blues scene. And yes, I think it's easy to break it down and say that it's the 1-4-5 and that it's old and, you know, somewhat, it's in some ways, I think blues can be treated as a parody of itself when in fact, in reality, when you go and you listen to some of these recordings, that were captured of these really stripped back situations with the guitar and a singer, and you listen to the
like
new
the Alan Lomax recording.
Totally.
You can't deny that shit is authentic.
It's true. Or any of the Chess records or any of the times in which these artists, you know, put themselves in positions to highlight their art. And they were doing it for the right reasons. They're trying to support themselves.
I think also, like, the people at that time, they were doing something very revolutionary with music. Like, it was new and fresh. And I think that bluegrass and blues kind of have the same thing where you have, they're kind of put into time capsules and you have purists who say you can't move this into the next century almost. And so it kind of gets stuck and it starts to sound, like you were saying, like a parody of itself. And that feels like a shame because it does feel like it hasn't kind of grown and changed and shifted and allowed to be part of our lives now.
There's something about, I mean, even what we were just saying there, there's something about like that time period and it's stripped away. And, you know, I have this opinion. I feel like maybe now, especially how music is today in today's terms, like it's transparent. Like we know that there's like songwriters, you know, and we know like there's sometimes a division of artists, but and you don't have to kill a man in Reno like to write Folsom Prison Blues. But there's just something so raw, authentic, oppressed even of some of that older stuff that I think encapsulated a complete generation, that a world that they didn't know, and kind of launched into something else called rock and roll, you know?
Yeah.
And so there is this thing I feel like that there's perception and authenticity, and where is that line, you know? Because I'm trying to think of somebody, I don't know, like Blind Willie. I know you guys are influenced some of his songs and stuff, like from a lot of his old catalogs and everything. I guess they're all old. But the thing of that shit was authentic. And it's so hard to imagine something like that being happening today. And so his perception was exactly what was happening that day, that time. And when he put out his music, it was authentic, right? And so trying to now do the thing, you know, blues and even folk and bluegrass, I mean, we have these murder songs. We got some really dark shit, you know? And so really trying to encapsulate this idea of authenticity. And I think sometimes, I think it has to go back to that education at some point. But especially for artists, though, like, I feel like you have to have perspective to make it authentic. Because if not, you never cross that line.
I see that. And I guess my question in response would be, like, what is authenticity? You know? And when I asked that question of myself, like, I was just recently reading this book about Skip James, who is, I think, one of the more underrated, you know, blues guys that was operating around the time of Robert Johnson and, you know, John Hurt and a lot of these guys that I think did have a lot of popular success. But when you think about their authenticity. Or somebody, let's focus in on Skip James. This is a guy who was committing to throwing away his reputation, because at the time, when you think about the music that was of the day, at the turn of the century, in the 20s and the 30s, it's church music, it's gospel. And so when you have people that are toying with a genre that is the devil music, and it's singing about sex and drugs and drink and the devil and the darker side of life and wanting to kill your woman or whatever you happen to need to channel into your music, you are essentially giving up your, you know, reputation as a respectable member of society. And so you didn't actually have as many of these guys going for it as you would think, because it was a commitment to be an outcast. And I think you see that same trend up into rock and roll. It's people who are outcast and into punk and trying to find a way to verbalize these emotions that don't feel like they're appropriate or have a place in common society. And that's when I think you see art that is moving. It's when people are, when they're digging into something deeper that could potentially blow back on them negatively.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And I think, yeah, and that's harder for us to find, you know, because we do live in an age where, you know, we have the Marilyn Mansons, we have the Slipknots, we have bands that have really pushed into these dark emotional territories, where it feels like potentially every vein has been tapped, every crevice of the earth has been discovered, and we've reaped all the metal that could potentially come up that makes us feel. But even that's not true, you know, because you can take it back. You can teach yourself as to where we've come from as people, as a culture, and retap into some of these lost ideas like the blues, and to help put it in place and create that context for, and oh my gosh, I'm waxing so eloquent right now. I am.
No, I love it. It's going on an Instagram post somewhere.
Shut up. Sorry. All right.
Anyway. You've had your coffee this morning.
I know. I was actually drinking my coffee out of my Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers mug that we bought whenever Tom Petty came through for his last show at Bridgestone. So I'm definitely jacked.
Well, okay, because the biggest thing, because it's a weird thing in my creative headspace, you know, and especially having these talks, you know, if somebody's awesome, you know, do they have to be fucked up in the head, you know, or are they just awesome and creative and talented at what they do, you know, have they truly lived the life of this renegade criminality thing to be authentic, or do they at least encapsulate that in their heart, mind, and spirit? You know, and then it's out on paper and it just feels this thing. Or you're just bloody freaking awesome. You know, like you got to be like, I don't know, a little messed up in the head to write a book called It and about a killer clown, you know, and that eats children and their souls. And so, I mean, Stephen King, I guess just even for that example, is just a creative dude.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't think you have to kill a man in Reno to write Folsom Prison Blues. And there's so many other examples we can spit out. But I think, where does authenticity like lie within you guys, especially if it's not even ill-defined yet? Because that's a great question too, I feel like. Like, what is authenticity?
It's being true to yourself. And I completely agree. I think that you do not have to have art and trauma go hand in hand merrily down the path. Like, I think that you can be an adjusted individual that has not, in fact, killed the man in Reno to write the song. And I mean, case in point, Skip James was a janitor. He was a janitor at a hospital, you know, and he was still able to create some of these most moving pieces of music because he was in tune with his humanity. And I think that that's half the battle. You know, you got to be creative and you got to be able to write a sentence like Stephen King in order to creep people out and tell a story. But then also it's the amount of work ethic. Like, you know, it didn't write itself.
Right.
Stephen sat there and stayed right with it and committed his time and his energy to bring it, you know, into life. And I think that that's pretty much what you ask of artists, is to commit the time to reflecting and to thinking about the thoughts and to feeling the feelings and figuring out how to put them into words. And however that comes out of you as an individual with your life path and the experiences that brought you to where you are and your childhood trauma, you know, not getting, you know, enough attention from mom or like whatever the little quirks and things that make you, that is the authenticity. And when you're willing to have the vulnerability and the strength to put that on a page and say the words to the people about what is closest to your heart.
I think something we need to add in the equation too is, I mean, oppression. Because, I mean, we're talking about Skip James, you know, some of the height of his career is like in the 60s, and he's a black man. Obviously, there's some oppression there, right? So I feel like for his music, just to have that sense of the darkness, there's somebody holding you down, which I can never know what that is or what that feels like. And I feel like oppression is part of that figure too, of being authentic to write the artistic things that some people are able to do and have it come out as authenticity, you know, because I think that oppression gives some perspective maybe. And so I don't know how you guys feel even about this conversation, but I mean, even women in music, I feel like that's an impressive thing. And I feel like the thing of like, we're still talking about it. Are we still oppressing it? Is it still a thing? Because I mean, we're going to get into it. I mean, she's a self-made man, you know? I mean, that the song itself is, it's full of irony, but in a way there is this thing of, okay, there's some a little oppression here and some angst within these artists that there's some authenticity behind it.
Yes, I think I'm going out on a limb, Megan, so come along with me or cut the limb and tell me I'm going too far. But like I think about the word oppression, and I absolutely feel that there is some truth in the idea that, you know, you don't get diamonds without, you know, immense pressure on coal that then creates the beautiful sparkly thing that, you know, we kill people over. So I think about Albert King as well, and he made that record, you know, live, it's Blues Power, live, can't remember the name of the record, but it's Blues Power, and it's this live performance in which he performs a song where he talks about the blues, what it means to have the blues. And sorry, my voice is kind of cracking. And he said, you know, if that baby can't get the bottle, this is a lyric that he's singing on stage. He says, if the baby can't get the bottle of milk fast enough, that baby's got the blues. If, you know, if a young girl wants to go out with her boyfriend and the mama says, no, that girl's got the blues. And of course, that's like an oversimplification, especially for somebody like Albert King or Skip James, who absolutely experienced incredible oppression that we will never understand as individuals. But that welcoming, that sense of, hey, like we're all humans together. And when we don't get what we want, or we are unable to achieve the things that we want to achieve, that gives us the blues. And I thought that was such like a welcoming and open-hearted way for him to like address the blues on stage and to make it accessible for all in a way, you know? And I think, yeah, like you say, being women making music in a male-dominated field, and not just the music industry, but then also if you zoom in even further into the blues and guitar-driven music, we're definitely outliers, and we've experienced, you know, some less than, you know, completely cakewalky experiences of, you know, having certain expectations, you know, set upon us or assumptions made about us. And it sucks. There is a lot of ignorance that can play into the pie that makes it taste not so so delicious,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It's all part of the thing that makes you who you are and how you respond to the pressures that are placed upon you, I think.
Yeah.
So we made self-made man.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, I feel like I got a pattern in your guys' history is that I feel like nothing has like held you back. Cause I feel like even self-producing some of the records that you got, I mean, you guys self-produced Venom and Faith, right? I didn't make that up in my head.
We've self-produced the last three. So Peach, Venom, and Faith, and Self-Made Man.
Okay. Yeah. I knew there was at least two, but there were three total. So, I mean, even taking up that flag, I mean, what was the reason behind of really just taking the reins into your own hands? Because, you know, one would think, I feel like there could be this perception of, oh, well, it is a man's world. We're just going to do it. We're going to do the thing. Or it's this thing of, we're just entrepreneurs and we don't think about it. We're just going to do it.
I was the one that felt really strongly that we should self-produce just because we've been in the room with some amazing producers, and this is no slight to them at all.
Yeah, right.
It's just that we were feeling like we weren't making the records that we really wanted to make. We really wanted to kind of try and create something that was rougher and rawer, and wanted to figure out how to do that. And I just felt like we
would be better served if we figured out how to do it on our own. Because I do think that we can be chameleons, because we've backed up a lot of other musicians, and we're pretty good at like sort of seamlessly sort of becoming part of a team, which sometimes when you're trying to create something of your own, that's not a good thing. Like, you want to be able to know what you're going for and accomplish it.
Right.
So I think that we were feeling headstrong, feeling like we were kind of butting heads, and then also maybe not quite getting what we were needing to get out of the record making process. So I just felt like we were better served if we did just do it ourselves. And Peach was the first one. I think that we did learn a lot from the process. You know, it's a lot more pressure. I do feel like, as a team, I feel like we enjoy pressure. Like, we like to be very goal oriented, and I think it's been one of the best decisions we've made in the past few years. It's definitely allowed us to make the records that we were hearing in our heads, and has been very, very empowering for the two of us. And I think that it's made it easier kind of stand up for ourselves and what we're wanting our music to, you know, accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference, I feel like, from, you know, Ken and moving on all the way up to Peach. It does feel like, oh, this is starting to hit a lot harder. There's some a lot of different emotions and themes that I've felt in the past. And then obviously Venom of Faith, it was huge. And then obviously Self-Made Man. I mean, like, this record definitely hits the hardest from even a production side. And I think even thematic wise too. And so even like going into this, I mean, what was your idea? You know, were you trying to like repeat any kind of success for yourself like in the past? Or was it like, let's just keep developing like what this is for us? Like, what was that, you know, this genesis of Self-Made Man?
Hey, this is Rebecca again. As an asterisk for all the blues fiends out there, I Googled it while I was listening to y'all talk, and it's Livewire Blues Power. That was the album that I was trying to remember that Albert King performed.
Oh, so, okay.
That yeah. said, the record set straight. You know, moving into Self-Made Man, I really do think there was a sense of wanting to recreate, because, I mean, obviously getting a Grammy nomination with Venom and Faith, that was a very clear sign that album connected. And so I think that we were tempted to want to maybe repeat some of the tricks that we had pulled with that album. But I don't think that Megan nor I, like, we're a little bit allergic to the bullshitty angle of like regurgitation. So yeah, instead right. we decided to take a fresh approach with the way that we built this album, really deeply inspired by the touring that we've done in support of Venom and Faith out on the road. And I think being willing to let it go somewhere new, and to not be afraid to risk throwing the baby out with the bathwater, in terms of the way that we were writing our songs, and even in the way that I was programming drums, or the sonic landscape that we created with this album, in the way that it differed and was a bit heavier than our previous albums. I think it served us well, because, I mean, if you're not growing and changing, then you're dead. You know, as a band, you got to be willing to take risks. And I'm glad that we made this album. I think that we're lyrically a little bit more uplifting, maybe at moments a little more challenging to people, especially having decided to call the album Self-Made Man. Like, that's a little bit more of a challenging move for Larkin Poe in terms
right.
of interviews that we then gave with the release of the record and everything. So we definitely broke some new ground, and I think that inspired a lot of growth, you know, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
Like, this one, Self-Made Man, I mean, immediately there's irony behind
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I didn't think about it until you guys actually brought it up, in which I think sparks a conversation that we all should really be having. Just these things of that we've already set in motion because of time, like Self-Made Man. Like, we're attaching
yeah. Oh, yeah.
women to be self-made men, you know, but they're self-made women, you know, but we don't think twice or three or four times to even like change our vernacular because of that.
Yeah,
true.
We've said that phrase a lot without really thinking about the fact that you are qualifying success by gender, and that's a little weird. kind of insidious. It's these little things that we do kind of almost without thinking about it. I do think that we like to poke fun at issues that are very close to our hearts as well. So I think, you know, self-made man, we've definitely got a lot of very confused questions. Like, why are you calling it self-made man? Like, why not self-made woman, women? And then we kind of explain that it's the phrase, and it's like, but I still don't understand. Why not self-made women? It's like, well, because that's not the phrase.
Yeah, but it creates this dialogue. I mean, that's the heart of it. You know, it creates this dialogue. But yeah, I immediately see the funny in it. And it's just like, okay, these women have a sense of humor, but there's also like a stark, dark sense of humor, like even behind it too. And I feel like it kind of leads into that conversation that we had before, oppression. I mean, I feel like you can't do something like this unless you felt just at least a little bit tried to be held back just because of who you are. You know, you can't poke fun at something unless, I guess you can, but it won't have that authenticity unless like you've experienced it yourself.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. And certainly, you know, just like you, I said self-made man many times in my life before it ever crossed my consciousness of what I was actually saying. And that was, I think, a very unsettling feeling, because you realize that, as Megan used the word insidious, and that to me feels very true. It's like there's this wallpaper on the room, you know, around us, and we hung pictures on it, and we've become so blind to the wallpaper. Like, what else is in the wallpaper that I'm not paying attention to outside of self-made man and, you know, all the bits and pieces of, you know, inequality and oppression that exist. And I think taking a few minutes to sit there and maybe try to take the pictures off the wall and look and see what's there, that's really important. I think that is the duty of artists, especially in this age, is, you know, try to see what's actually there. Don't just distract yourself.
Danger Angel is one that like pokes out in my memory of like, oh, this is like really good. It feels like an anthem of almost like the disenfranchised.
I think there is this theme of this woman, this larger than life woman, that she kind of pops up in a lot of the songs. I think that, well, I'll let Rebecca take it. She is the main songwriter for the band, but, you know, from like Bleach Blonde Bottle Blues to Danger Angel to She's a Self-Made Man. It's like the idea of a larger than life woman character that I really love. It feels very empowering, and I love it.
Oh, I'm glad. Well, I think it speaks to the, you said disenfranchised, and I think that that's a very appropriate word, because the franchises that we, you know, that are huge, especially in terms of, you know, media, when you've got Disney and, you know, all these movie companies that are, in a lot of ways, have been informing us as to the gender stereotypes and the gender roles that we all serve. And, you know, having been born in the early 90s and watching a lot of the Disney princess era, and even into the, you know, the early 2000s, some of the movies in which you watch the damsel in distress, and it's like you kind of repeat this tired old tripe of the woman in the position of weakness and needing to be saved and externalizing all her self-worth into, you know, her romantic endeavors and all this crap that at a certain point just gets old. It gets old to see, I will not show it to my child, because it informs this, I think, inauthentic sense of self. It's like, no, actually, you are just fine as you, you know, and we can create, we can write the characters that we want to see represented. And that's,
well,
and that's
does, I think it does a disservice to our entire culture, population, like world, if 51% of these perfectly capable people who have the possibility of being something very great that will push humankind forward, if they're disenfranchised or taught to believe something about themselves, it's like, it's just doing us all a disservice.
Which is, I think also why I am such a huge fan of Billie Eilish and the way that she is taking the music industry over by storm, her and her brother.
Right.
And
right.
The lyrics that she is choosing to write. Like, when you listen to her new song, and it's her new single, and it's brilliant. It's a brilliant song of a young girl writing a love song to her future and her own possibility. It has nothing to do with, you know, having a boyfriend or
right.
being accepted by the group
right.
or
being pretty enough or any of this, you know, insignificant crap that plagues us as right. the most important and deserving of all of our attention. It's like, no, actually, there's other stuff to think about. There's other stuff to do. And I am a huge fan of that type of narrative, you know, that stepping outside of the pack and looking at the pack for what it is and what it represents. And then you get to choose whether or not you want to take part, and if you do, how you want to take part.
Except for, I guess, Danger Angel, the character in that song, is that she's a little bit of a mess, maybe. Mm. She's a little bit of a bad girl.
Right, character. Right. I mean, she's the leather jacket smoking under the bleachers, like in a football game, and like beating up the quarterback. I mean, she's that kind of person, I feel like. But I mean, the whole thing about this, and that I really like this record, is because it's like, yeah, it doesn't play in, and I don't think you guys have ever done this, but you're 100% right. We play into these perceptions, and we've have for so long, and so few, and it's, I feel like there's a turn now. And it's only been in recent years that we start changing those perceptions of women, of Black people, of Asian descent. I mean, it's, and I could be one-sided, I don't know, as just this white guy that's just trying to empathize. But it's, I feel like only in recent years have we really honed in and focused on changing these perceptions and the conversations and the dialogues and even in art.
I think that
like
you're-
in recent years.
I think that you're hitting the nail on the head. Personally, I agree. I think it, you don't know what you don't know till you suddenly have a blinding glimpse of the obvious that you don't know it. And then suddenly that opens up a whole world of possibility where you can acknowledge and accept and educate and move forward, create something new.
You got it. You just got to just make something new. It's really easy. Just go do it. Megan and Rebecca, I really appreciated the conversation. And we got through it, guys. You got through it. Thanks for sticking with us, allowing me to be human. And I hope you guys can be better humans as well. Be sure to go check out that record, Self-Made Man. It is out on all streaming platforms. Go listen right now. Of course, they got Larkin Poe Podcast. That is happening next date, October 4th. Go get your tickets at larkinpoe.com. And go give them a follow on any of their social platforms, Instagram, Twitter, at Larkin Poe. While you're at it on the social train there, be sure to stop by at SMI Podcast on Facebook and Twitter. But then we also have at Unofficial Brandon, where I'm allowed to kind of do the things that I do. I mean, I'm on TikTok. I don't know how that's really going to work out, but it's still there. Instagram as well. If you guys enjoyed this conversation, you got something out of it, maybe you know somebody else too. All I ever ask is that you just share this episode with a friend. You share it on social media, whatever your friend group is kind of doing the thing. Just share it with them. I appreciate it. Of course, you can always subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. You'll have new episodes every Tuesday, but every once in a while, a nice little surprise will pop out through the week. All right, folks, that's it for me. I really think it is. This is Brandon signing off with SMI Podcast. And I love you guys. Take care of yourself. Thanks for letting me do this for the past 5 years. Let's just keep going. Be kind. Don't be stupid. And love one another. Happy surviving out there. See you next week.